8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman, and tonight I'll be your host. Each week, Hank, Greg, Mary, Tatiana, and I, along with our extended family of guest hosts and storytellers, each week we celebrate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys and then bring us safely home. Tonight is the third and final week of KPFT's Winter Fun Drive and our last opportunity to ask you to contribute. Pacifica Radio is 100% listener-sponsored, so please give us a call right now at 713-526-5738 to pledge your generous donation. We'll pledge you on the air. We'll thank you on the air unless you say otherwise. 713-526-5738. You can also donate online. Go to www.kpft.org, then to donations, and be sure to scroll to So What's Your Story as the show you wish to support. And while we're talking about the fund drive, I've already got two people to thank. Last week, as we were going off the air, Jenny Campbell and Sneha Desai called in to pledge a donation. So thank you. We're saying thank you to you and thank you to all of the others who are about to call in now. If you tuned in last week, you'll remember that Greg hosted, and he featured an amazing variety of stories, personal stories, folk tales, even a science fiction story. Tonight we're going to feature another type of story. Some people call them oral histories. I like to call them historical personal stories. The stories we're going to feature are ones I've collected from my hometown in North Carolina. We're doing this in commemoration of Black History Month, but also, I might add, in commemoration of the 146th birthday of my town's incorporation, which is February 28th today. The stories are all going to revolve around the theme of growing up in the Jim Crow era, the segregated South during the 1920s and 1930s. Joining me to help tell these stories are two of my favorite actors. Rachel Dixon is Associate Artistic Director of the Ensemble Theater. She's also founder and artistic director of Driven Theater Company, as well as president of Houston Scriptwriters. Rachel has taught theater and communications in just about every college in Houston. And speaking of the Ensemble Theater, Chris Wycliffe was a founding member of the Ensemble. He's a native of Dayton, Texas. He moved to Houston in 1975, began acting professionally in 1977. Chris has appeared on stage at various venues, including Stages, Equinox Theater, and the Dallas Theater Center. He's performed in many industrial films and commercials. He's a member of the Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of TV and Radio Artists. Today he works in the corporate world, but he dreams of one day returning to the stage. Rachel, Chris, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Glad to be here.
And thank you especially for coming during Winter Fun Drive. Rachel, you were here during Fall Fun Drive.
Yes, I was.
You're a veteran. Yeah. Rachel, could you tell our listeners why KPFT is important to you?
Sure. I really appreciate the diversity of programming. Not only on this side of the microphone, you bring a diverse group together, but you attempt to reach a diverse population in all of the programming. And it's so varied. When I turn it on, you never really know. Well, I know because I know the programming, but it's always different from time to time to time that I listen. So that's great fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And Chris?
Everything's personal with me. And
tell your story.
In 1970, about the time KPFT came on the air, I was waiting to be drafted and living out in Dayton at my grandmother's house.
This is Dayton, Texas.
Dayton, Texas. And KPFT was my lifeline to the world. It was a way of connecting to something outside of small town Texas. I still remember it fondly.
And what happened a few years later after you finished the service?
Several years later, I came back to Houston and I met a young woman who was a volunteer at KPFT, and so I became a volunteer. I have no memory of what I did, how much time I spent here. Whatever Marion told me to do, that's what I did. So I think of KPFT fondly because of that.
You were in love with Marion, with KPFT. That's a wonderful testimonial. Well, we'll have more time to talk in the final segment of the show, but let's start things off with some stories. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell the first one to kind of set the stage. And then Rachel and Chris, you all are going to jump in and tell the next four stories. And in between, we're going to do some fun drive talk as well. Right. So here's my story. When I was a high school student, my hometown celebrated its centennial birthday. My brother, Toby, was a college student, and he had this idea to write a history of the town over the summer holiday, summer break, and then get extra independent study credit for it in the fall. He recruited me as a high school student to be his research assistant. One of my assignments was to research the history of the schools in our community. For the white schools, I went to the library in Raleigh, the state archives, and I read the county education board minutes, the old newspapers, history books. I found lots of good information. When it came to the black schools, I discovered the so-called official publications had pretty much ignored that whole area of history. So by that time, my brother was back in college, and I asked my father, well, what do I do? Because we had a deadline coming up. He said, you just need to go talk to some people. It's not that complicated. And then he came back the next day and he said, call Ms. Vader DeLoach. She'll help you. So the next thing I know, I'm at Ms. DeLoach's house, and she's also invited over her friend of 75 years, Ms. Mary Baldwin Stewart. At the time, these ladies were in their late 70s, and I was a 16-year-old teenager. They were black. I was white. By the standard categories of the day, we were worlds apart. And yet, that's not the way I felt when Ms. DeLoach welcomed me into her home. The ladies pulled out this old school photograph, and they laid it on the dining room table. It was a building and about 100 students standing in front. I didn't know it at the time, but I now know that that's probably the only existing photograph from the first 50, 60, 70 years of African-American education in my side of the county. They began naming almost every child in the picture, and I began writing down names, and my brother put all that in the book. I was beginning to feel like a real historian. At one point, Ms. DeLoach pointed out herself in a photograph. She said, look at me. I'm the same age there that you are now. Actually, I think she was 14. I was 16, but I was an immature 16-year-old. She was a mature 14-year-old. And then she paused for a few seconds to let that sink in. And that's when it hit me. We're all on the same journey. She's a few miles in front of me. But maybe the things she learned on that journey might be helpful for me and for my generation. And that's really when I fell in love with history and with historical stories. That was 1972, and I still remember to this day many of the things they told me that afternoon about African-American education in my community, just like my dad said they would. One, they said that in those days tax money was supposed to go for black children and white children, but it just basically went for the white children. So black schools only went to the sixth grade. They only met for 3 or 4 months a year. They generally had one room and one or two teachers. They said this Apex Normal and Collegiate Institute, their school that was in that picture, it was so poor it had no water, no heat, and no desks. The students sat on old wooden benches and they wrote on their laps. And these two ladies who were so prim and so proper had a good laugh remembering how those benches had splinters. When Ms. DeLoach said, I'm not so sure, I still don't have some of those splinters in me. And she and Ms. Stewart looked at each other, and they broke out laughing, and I couldn't help but laugh as well. When they were little girls, they told me there was no public high school in the entire state of North Carolina for African Americans. Sixth grade was as far as they could go in the public system. And they told me other stories. They told me about the Rosenwald School that was built in our community in 1932, how Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington got together, built 5,300 schools for black kids in the South in the early 20th century, and our community was the beneficiary of one. But that wasn't until 1932 that the school went beyond the sixth or seventh grade. There was lots more, and we put it all in the book. In time, I realized that by capturing the stories of old people, whether they were black or white, I wasn't just capturing the social history of my community. I was really capturing the social history of the entire South, because my community was really a microcosm of the South. Well, I went off to college, grad school. I had a career in the Texas Medical Center here in Houston, and spent most of my adult life 1,000 miles from home. But I was always ruminating about those stories, that afternoon with those ladies, and wishing I could collect more stories. And some of those older members of our community began dying, and I said, we're losing those stories. And that's when an opportunity arose. It was 2008. My mother's health was deteriorating. She needed some help. I started working part-time so I could be more available to go there and be with her. And while I was visiting her, I got this idea. Why not use this time while I'm here to interview more of these old people, just like I'd interviewed Ms. Deloach and Ms. Stewart, and use those stories to expand and republish that book my brother had written years ago. And I thought I could even involve my mother in the process. She loved history, and she knew all the old people on that side of the county, so she would be a great research assistant for me. So I went to work. I conducted about 30 oral history interviews of our community senior citizens. And tonight, with the help of Rachel and Chris, I'd like to share a few of those stories with you. Now, we're going to start with Ms. Clee Esther Raines. That's C-L-E and then E-S-T-H-E-R, Raines. One afternoon, it was about 10 years ago, my mother invited Ms. Raines over to the house for tea. The two of them were enjoying talking so much that I wasn't sure if I'd ever get a chance to do my oral history interview. You see, Ms. Clee Esther was 98 years old at the time. I was worried that my relatively young 85-year-old mother was going to tire Ms. Clee Esther out. Boy, was I wrong. Ms. Clee Esther had plenty of energy to talk to both my mother and me. Here's what she told us. This is her story.
I was born in 1911 out in the country near Apex. I started school at St. Grove's, at Scotts Grove, when they just had one teacher and one room. I had to walk 3 miles to get there. When I was 8 or 9, I started going to Apex. That was one room, too. We walked 5 to 6 miles. My friends walked 7 miles. We would meet up with them and walk together. We didn't have buses in those days. The white children had buses, but they would pass us in their buses, and they would pick at us. They rode buses to their school, and we walked to ours. When I was 13 or 14, Mom sent me to Barry O'Kelly Training School in Raleigh because the black school in Apex stopped at the sixth grade. I boarded there, and it was $12 a month. My mother had high ideas for her family. She made all kinds of sacrifices, but that was a lot of money, so I was only able to go 1 year, and that was all the education I got. But that was more than most black children grew up with. So, in that sense, I was blessed. Oh, I'm so old I can remember when the first cars came to our little town. There was a man named Mr. Gillum. He was so proud of himself for getting a car. It was a T model. I still remember when he was learning how to drive that car. The only thing he'd ever driven before that was a mule. So he was putting that car in the shed, and he wanted to stop it, but he got confused. He started yelling, "Whoa, whoa, whoa!" He hit the back wall of that shed. We just laughed and laughed. And now I'm going to tell you about something that wasn't so funny. Segregation. You know about Rosa Parks. Well, I can do one better than her. I was thrown off the back of the bus. One Sunday afternoon, we were going to go see a sick man. He lived in Carpenter. That was 8 miles away. We decided to take the Dorman Dunn bus. Now, there were 10 of us, and we each had 25 cents. That was enough money for one way. So we decided we'd ride there and walk back. We got on, paid our money, and there was just the back seat for us to sit. Now, the driver started toward Dorman. Then he stopped the bus. He said, "Now, you niggas think I'm going to ride you all over the world for 25 cents? Y'all get out." So we had no choice but to get out of the bus and walk. We walked there and we walked back. And so we got back really late. The next morning, we had to get up early and burn tobacco. Now, there was not a lot you could do when somebody called you the N-word. Mostly you just try to laugh as best you could and go on. But sometimes there was something you could do. My friends who work for white people fixed their food. I heard some of them say, "I spit in their food because they mistreated me." My friends couldn't get even, but this is one thing they could do. When I was a little girl, we didn't have cars. We had a mule and a wagon. And when we came to town, we weren't allowed to ride on it. So we had to park outside of town and walk in. Only white people were allowed to ride their wagon into town. When I used to go to Raleigh, I'd look through the windows of the dime store and see the white people in the restaurants eating Jell-O. It was in a glass bowl, and it looked so good. It looked so pretty. All those colors together in that bowl, boy. But I couldn't get any because of segregation. Now, after segregation ended, I told my husband, "I'm going to go to that store and get some Jell-O." Oh, I was born in it, you know, segregation. And I thought I would stay in it. But God saw different. He wanted us to live together, like all those colors in that pretty bowl of Jell-O.
Thank you, Rachel. Mm-hmm. Stories like these are the ones you hear only on So What's Your Story? We'd like to keep bringing these stories to you, but we can only do it if you give us a call at 713-526-5738. It only takes a minute to make that call. And while you're calling, I'll introduce Reverend William Davis. I interviewed him at his home back in 2009. In fact, I went there twice. He was a Baptist preacher, and, well, he had a lot to say. As I entered his home, Reverend Davis said, "Let me introduce you to my wife." She looked at me, I looked at her, and we both said at the same time, "I know you." I didn't realize his wife was Miss Sarah Davis. You see, when I was in high school, I volunteered in a tutoring program that she directed. She was always really nice to me, but I never put two and two together and figured out she was Reverend Davis's wife. Mm-hmm. What threw me off was she smoked cigarettes. I didn't realize you could be a Baptist preacher's wife and smoke cigarettes. All this to say that neither Reverend William Davis nor his wife, Miss Sarah Davis, were cookie-cutter people, as you're about to see.
I was born in 1920. We were sharecroppers about a mile north of Apex. My mother made all our clothes. Our church clothes were a pair of homemade pants with buttons at the waist, and a shirt with buttonholes at the bottom. You buttoned your pants to your shirt, and you didn't need a belt. We did not wear shoes except in the winter. My mother made another outfit for our work and play. They were overalls. Very seldom did you buy any clothes from a store. On the first Sunday, we went to First Baptist. On the second Sunday, we attended St. Mary's AME. On the third Sunday, Christian Home Church. And on the fourth Sunday, St. Paul's CME. Sometimes we'd go to New Hill for a special service, and we'd walk 7 miles each way. In those days, there was no set time to end the service. If the spirit got in him, you were there until whenever the preacher finished. After church let out, we played ball, baseball. Each community had its own team. Holly Springs, Fuquay, Pittsboro, Morrisville. Friendship and New Hill had a combined team. In the summer, we'd play every Saturday and every Sunday after church and every holiday. We started on Easter Monday and went until after Labor Day. For away games, somebody would borrow a truck and we loaded up on it. They charged a nickel a person if you had it. Lots of fans came. Fans would fellowship together before and after the game, but during it, they'd separate. If we were beating them, we'd talk to them, you know, trash talk. If they were beating us, they'd talk to us. We all knew each other. We'd go to the same dance halls, so it was a friendly rivalry. Dance halls. They were big in those days. Starting when we were about 15, 16, we'd go to Lonnie Jones Dance Hall. It was a very popular place, not just for our community, but for all the black communities in western Wake County. Lonnie Jones Dance Hall on South Main Street, where Albright Funeral Home is now. That's quite a change, come to think of it. Lonnie Jones Dance Hall had a piccolo. That's an old-timey jukebox. You'd put in a nickel for one song or a dime for three. We liked jitterbug music, and we liked to dance. There was Lil Green, Count Basie, Louis Armstrong, Cab Calloway. Lonnie Jones was a successful businessman. He had a dance hall, beauty parlor, and cafe. He took a liking to me. We'd sit there and talk and laugh. He'd tell people, "That's my boy there." Lonnie Jones was a role model for me, and he kept me in line. Now, the only place in Apex I knew of where white and black people went in together was Jimmy Jones' hot dog stand. Jimmy Jones was a great big white man, 300 pounds, but he had a tiny place. He only had one door, and white and black people both went in that same door. But if you were black, you had to eat it outside. There were some good hot dogs. A nickel for one, three for a dime, just like the songs on the piccolo. If you went to a drugstore to get ice cream, you had to go through a special door in the back. You'd stay back there, and they'd bring you your ice cream. You didn't mingle at the counter with the white people. The movie theater had a special door on the side for black people. We'd go upstairs and sit in the balcony. I graduated from the Rosenwald School in 1937, seventh grade. Then I went to Barry O'Kelly in Raleigh for 1 year. I did not have the privilege of continuing. My father was a sharecropper, and we did not have the funds. My dad needed us on the farm.
When I heard Reverend Davis say these words, "I did not have the privilege of continuing," that made quite an impression on me. I thought about what it might have been if Reverend Davis and other young, gifted, and black students had been able to pursue at least a high school education, if not college and beyond. At the same time, I marveled at all that Reverend Davis did accomplish with his eighth grade education. As you can well imagine, I developed a huge respect for Reverend Davis. And by the way, he just passed away in December, just a couple of months ago. He was, I think, 98 years old. He was a treasure trove of information for my brother and me on the history of the community. If you read our book, he's footnoted in every chapter. So I went back for a second interview, and here's what he told me.
Like most black people in those days, we were sharecroppers. We lived on the Herndon farm, about a mile outside of town. Mrs. Herndon, she was a very unusual white woman for that day and age. We would eat at her table as far back as I can remember. If Mrs. Herndon thought you were still hungry at the end of the meal, she'd fix more food. When I was a baby, if my mama had to go somewhere, she would leave me with Mrs. Herndon. Mrs. Herndon had a baby the same age as me, and Mrs. Herndon would take care of both of us. If we were hungry, she'd feed both of us, one baby on each breast, which again was quite unusual for that day and age. And if Mrs. Herndon went away, my mother would do the same for her and her child. Mrs. Herndon's daughters were like our sisters. When we were teenagers, they wanted to learn how to jitterbug. My brother and I were good dancers, so we taught them. They had a record player, and we did it inside their home. You had to be very careful doing something like that. We wouldn't have thought of doing that in public. This was something we did in the family, and it stayed there. I trusted them. I knew where the line was at, and I didn't cross it. When you finished dancing, that was it. You didn't try to go any further than that. Mrs. Herndon was a woman I looked up to even after I was grown. When I was in the service, I wrote her letters, sent her pictures. When I came out of the service, she had those pictures on the mantel. Once I left the safety of the Herndon family, it was a different ball game. It was a common thing to hear racial slurs. If I did something about it, I was doomed. I would be put in jail. So I would just act like I didn't hear it. A black guy used to work for Apex Cleaners in the 1930s. He went to buy a $5 battery for his car, and he paid cash. They were so convinced that a black man wasn't supposed to have $5 that they took him to court. They accused him of taking it out of somebody's pants at the cleaners. If a black man was caught with a white woman, poof, it was automatic death. You'd be lynched, executed, or sent to prison for life. I've heard of instances where a white woman would flirt with a black man, and if he didn't flirt back, she'd accuse him of rape. Of course, if he did flirt back, she might accuse him of the same thing. If a white girl spoke to you and you knew her, you might say hi, but you'd keep walking. You had to be careful. I've known of some who got accused of touching a white woman, and they disappeared. We never knew whether they were lynched or ran off to hide. We kept our distance from white girls. With the Herndon girls, it was different. We were family, at least inside the house. These were dangerous times for black people. I guess the only thing that kept it in perspective was the stories we heard about times that were even worse. You know, slavery. My grandfather was Richard Maynard. He told me that when he was a little boy, he and his mother were sold at the slave market in Fayetteville. They weren't arriving from Africa. They were being traded from one slave owner to another, and they were being separated from the rest of their family. They were treated like animals. Grandpa said music was one of the keys to their survival. The spirituals. Another was all the stories in the Bible about the children of Israel. That's why our parents and grandparents passed down to us their knowledge about the spirituals. It was important to them that we know the meaning of those songs and where they came from. They used these songs to cope with the evils of slavery, and a lot of the songs had a double meaning. I'll give you an example. Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Ain't gonna study war no more. That was our ancestors' way of communicating. That meant you'll be free from the oppression. War refers to anything that oppresses you. In those days, it was slavery. They were looking forward to a time when they would no longer be slaves. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. That was a slave song about being free from slavery. For some, it was about Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad literally coming to help you escape to the North. For others, it was more general, the idea of getting out of slavery any way possible. For all the slaves, it was a song about hope to endure unspeakable hardship. Because the songs had a double meaning, white people thought slaves were only singing praises. And they were singing praises, but they were also singing about the problems that had been caused by the slave masters. So singing was really their salvation. And their other salvation was stories, Bible stories. The stories in the Bible about the children of Israel being delivered out of Egypt had a lot of meaning for our slave ancestors. The children of Israel were slaves just like us, and the message of the Bible is that God delivered them. That was a great source of hope for our ancestors, and it still is for us today. We're out of slavery, but we still have barriers.
What is it about Reverend Davis's story that speaks to you?
Reverend Davis might be my father, who, by the way, died last year as well at the age of 99. And I see so much similarity in the devotion to community, to uplifting, to teaching, to passing on my father to the end, when I would think that a man would be basking in what he's achieved, being prepared for the next world. He was constantly asking, have I done enough? What more can I do? And I think I see that, hear echoes of that in Reverend Davis.
Wow. Rachel, any thoughts?
About what I heard in the story?
In that story or in the previous story with Miss Cleister?
Well, what impresses me is hope and humor. Mm-hmm. That we forget. We become very downtrodden, and these folks lived through such horrendous circumstances. Mm-hmm. And yet both of them, in his piece in particular, the sense of hope that's an undercurrent, which speaks to the writing. I mean,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It speaks to how you captured the words.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the humor for Miss Cleo, that she can still smile and have humor.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm struck looking back. I'm kicking myself for not asking more about some of the troubles of those days, but what they liked to talk about was the hopeful and the humorous mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, a way to cope.
Way to cope. They were very buoyed by that. Well, Tatiana, Hank, what you got in there?
So we got two donations throughout the show so far.
Uh-huh.
Two very generous donations. One donor who wants to be anonymous.
Uh-huh.
And then one to Alexander Kelly. Thank you both for these great donations. Because of you, we're going to stay on the air.
Right. Can you say the amount, or do we not do that?
I don't think we do that, no.
Okay. Okay. All right. We'll just say $1 million.
Let's say it's very generous.
Yeah. Wonderful. Okay. Does Hank have anything to add over there? They're switching headphones
oh,
now.
Oh, yes, but it's well worth it, yes.
Yeah.
What a great show. You know, this show was a little more significant than I ever realized. Chris and Rachel are talking about the implications of what KPFT has made on their life. And Chris probably remembers that the Ku Klux Klan bombed this place. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get any more significant than that. It really doesn't. I'm thinking about Anthony Graves, who was told that he was going to be exonerated by his attorney, Nikki Cazares, who made that announcement on this station because we were the ones who allowed her to do that. So we didn't have to wait over the weekend to know that he would be free. We've had a mother on that I hosted, I remember years ago, who talked about the murder of her daughter for the first time on the air. We have folklorists. We have people who share stories of tragedy and jubilation. And I'm almost in tears because in 2008, when I started the show as an open journal, I was told very explicitly, and Warren, you know the story, that I was told that, well, you know, go ahead and do it, but storytelling probably won't make it. And we were really the first venue on storytelling. And we've made it, and we've made it well because of shows like this. I'm thinking about how I struggled getting guests on the air, and I'm listening to these two incredible tellers right now, and I'm in tears because of the growth that we've accomplished. You know, when Lewis Hill started Pacifica Radio in 1948, it was done because of the peace movement. He believed that radio could exist without corporate sponsorship, and that's why we ask people to donate as generously as they can to 713-526-5738, JAM KPFT. You can also text the word GIVE to 713-526-5738, and you can get online for a donation link. But, you know, we have come a very long way, and it's because of our listeners that we aim to stay here. Because the way that stories connect is a mode of expression like no other, and we know that. So I just want to thank everybody who's been associated with this program, Tatiana, Warren, our guest tonight, you know, Greg, Mary, everyone, because we have a real place in Houston broadcast institutionalization. We exist for good reason. And I'm just as proud as can be. And I wanted to thank again our very generous donors tonight, and we're looking forward to more. Just a reminder, 713-526-5738, or go online to kpft.org and scroll over to donations. Tell us how you want to pay. Don't use my credit card, but tell us how you want us to pay. And then, this is important, scroll over to So What's Your Story as the program that you support. We are sandwiched between two great programs, Progressive Forum with Wally, which is a real institution, and we are followed by the Tennyson Tapes by Lars. We have DJs that drop needles on tunes you're only going to hear here all day and all night. This station rocks in so many different ways, and I just wanted to thank everybody for being such an essential part of it.
Thanks, Hank. And I believe Tatiana has even some others to thank. She's getting her headphones on now. She's going to thank our sponsor.
He was just hogging the headphones.
Yeah.
But a big thank you, as always, to our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesday of the month at Temple Emanuel. That's right across the street from Rice University. We encourage you to check the Guild's website to keep up with storytelling events around the city and state. In fact, a big one is coming up March 7th through the 10th in Denton. It's the 34th Annual Texas Storytelling Festival. And I know Warren and Hank are going to be there. Yep. And as for the Moth, because of spring break schedule, next month they'll meet the third Tuesday, March 19th, at Warehouse Live. And you'll hear funny stories, riveting stories, crazy stories, heartwarming stories, all in one. A wonderful evening. And circling back to our own show, Eric Keene is hosting next week, and his guests will be three policewomen who will tell stories about being street cops from a female perspective.
And that's going to be a great show. I can't wait.
And all great shows are here on 90.1 FM KPFT. Catch us on 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. And online at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Finding more and more ways to bring you engaging stories from passionate storytellers, like the ones you're hearing tonight from Rachel, Chris, and Warren.
What we're doing tonight is telling stories I collected from real people in my hometown of Apex, North Carolina. Ordinary people, perhaps, but with extraordinary stories to tell. We'll kick off the second half of the show with stories from Ms. Emma Jones Council. Like Reverend Davis, Ms. Council made a point of telling me that she grew up hearing family stories about slavery, and this had a big impact on the way she thought about things.
My papa had a half-brother named Hilliard Jones. He was a lot older than papa, and he was born a slave somewhere right around Apex. Uncle Hilliard told us the only way he could get a biscuit was to dance for the white people. He said the biscuits were hard and old, but he didn't know any other kind, and he was hungry. He said he danced many times for a biscuit. Uncle Hilliard said a time came in 1865 when he was going to be sold to a man named Upchurch, but it didn't happen because Sherman's army arrived the day before he was supposed to be sold. He said if the Yankees hadn't come through, he would have been sold and he would have been separated from his family, and his name would have been Upchurch. In those days, the slaves took the names of the masters. That's the story of Uncle Hilliard. As for me, I was born in 1921, and when I was 2 years old, my mother died. I stayed with different people after that until I was about six, and my father remarried. My father was a sharecropper.
He worked for Mr. Mac Upchurch. His farm was there, right where the Olive Chapel Village is now, next to Hunter Street and Highway 55. One of the barns is still standing beside Olive Church and next to the shopping center. Here's how sharecropping worked. The white farmer, he furnished the land and the mules and loaned you the money for the supplies. Papa provided the labor, along with Mama and the children. Papa would plant 5 or 6 acres and farm it. When we sold the tobacco, Papa would get half the money, minus the cost of the fertilizer, minus the cost of other supplies, minus the money we borrowed the year for food and everything else. The white man kept a book. When Papa got through paying off his debt, oftentimes he wouldn't have anything left. He'd go right back into debt. Sharecropping was a good deal for the white man, but not for us. One way we coped was by laughing. One day, when I was about 12, we were putting up tobacco on Mr. Upchurch's farm. Upchurch saw us resting between tobacco sleds, and he didn't think we should be resting. He didn't believe in people sitting, especially black people. Upchurch thought he was so smart. He would hang that tobacco himself, and he started climbing up into the top of that barn. Now, Upchurch was a big old man. He was about 5'8", but he weighed 300 to 350 pounds. It's amazing the tear poles could even hold him. So I was careful not to stand directly under him. So I started handing the tobacco up to him. I turned my back to get another stick, and I heard this loud noise. Boom! And it was Mr. Upchurch. He fell off the tear poles and onto the furnace. He damaged that furnace pretty bad. We laughed, but we didn't let him know we laughed. His son was there. And he laughed, too. But he didn't let his daddy see him, either. He went on around behind the barn. Oh, it took all of us to pull him up off that furnace, or what was left of it. He said he didn't hurt himself. But I'll tell you this. That was the last time he ever tried to hang tobacco.
There's a lot in that story that's painful to listen to, and sometimes laughter was the only response possible, and even that sometimes sounds like had to be done in secret. I hope times have changed, and I know KPFT and the Pacifica Network are committed to being that change. We're in the final week of the Winter Fun Drive. Did I mention that? I think I did. Please help us keep stories like this on the radio by dialing 713-526-5738. Now, the final historian and storyteller we're going to feature tonight is Ms. Edith Lynn Raines, no close relation, at least, to Ms. Cleaster Raines. About 10 years ago, she and her husband Carlos invited me to their home. Mrs. Raines served me Coca-Cola, and there was no small talk. She got right down to business.
My grandmother was named Pharisee Lynn, and she lived with us when I was growing up. Her mother was a slave on a farm just a few miles from Apex. My grandmother told me things that her mother told her. She told me that if a white man wanted a black slave woman, she didn't have a choice, and she couldn't talk about it. If she or any slave talked about it, they would be killed. She told me that the lighter-skinned slaves worked in the house and the darker-skinned slaves worked in the field. The master showed favoritism to the lighter-skinned children because he knew they were his. When I was a little girl, my father was a sharecropper. One Saturday, our whole family had to work for the white people. Now, whatever they said to do, you had to do it. Even children 6 years old. There was no playtime after you were 6 years old. You'd show up there first thing in the morning, and they worked you all day. You'd rake their yard, wash their clothes with a washboard, take care of the tobacco sticks, carry the water. When they planted tobacco, the children had to carry the water. Even a mature 5-year-old would carry the water bucket. They had a small bucket for the little children, a big bucket for the big children, and a medium-sized bucket for those in between. They didn't pay my father with money. They would give him some old clothes or a piece of hog meat. It was like slavery. One day, I will never forget, my daddy confronted the white farmer. He said, "My wife and girls will not do that. I rent your farm. You did not rent my family." I always admired my daddy for protecting his family so we wouldn't be forced to be like slaves. That was a risky thing to do in those days. That was 1938. I was 9 years old. For the next 3 years, my father did all the extra jobs he could find so he could make a down payment on a farm. He bought a farm in Friendship, and we moved there. That was 1941. I was 12 years old, and life got a lot better. Once my daddy owned his own farm, we had a whole new life. One nice thing I remember is the way everybody in Friendship pulled together. We were a community. For example, when it came time to put up the corn, you would invite the neighbors over. The men would shuck it and put it in the crib. While they worked, they would laugh and tell jokes. Somebody might play a mouth harp, and they drank corn liquor or scuppernong wine or blackberry wine. Meanwhile, the women would cook. When they finished putting the corn in the crib, everybody would come in and eat a big dinner. And wasn't just corn, either. If you needed a barn or log house, your neighbors would help you. The men would come and put it up, and the women would cook. In fact, that's exactly what happened when Carlos and I got married. People came and built us a barn. People didn't have money in those days, but we had each other.
At that point, Mr. Carlos, who was the introvert in the marriage, he finally started talking, and we published his story in our book, but we don't have time to tell that tonight. But one of the things he talked about was farming, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to take out a barn of tobacco so that when the sun came up, it would be ready to fill when the other workers arrived. He told me how to make lye soap, and the recipe is not a secret. You use hog fat, in case you're wondering. But the thing I remember most was he shared a very vivid memory of childhood when he was sick, and the town doctor, he said he would, quote, come and sit with you until your temperature went down, which sometimes was all night long. And he said, when you're a child and you're in pain, you remember that. You never forget it. So I mentioned that anecdote at a program we did just about 3 or 4 weeks ago in my hometown back in North Carolina. It was an audience full of people, mostly older people like me, from the community. And I looked out in the audience, and who should I see but this doctor, Dr. Goodwin's granddaughter, was there. She was sitting there. Her name is Claire Goodwin. 90 years after that evening in which her grandfather had shown compassion for this sick child, his granddaughter got to hear that story. And that, my friends, is the power of stories, to bring back to life the struggles of the past, to recognize the heroes of the past, like Dr. Goodwin staying up all night with that sick child, and to bring people together and to bring reconciliation, closure, and healing. These are the stories we bring every week on So What's Your Story, but we can only keep bringing them to you if we have your support. So please, this is your last chance. This is the last week of the fund drive. Give us a call at 713-526-5738. And while those phones begin to ring, Chris, I've got a question for you, and I've got a question for Rachel.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
First of all, thank you.
My pleasure.
You've shared your talents with our listeners, and you've made history come alive. Chris, you said in your bio that you had a dream of one day returning to the stage. Well, this is kind of like a stage. What was it like for you?
Oh, I enjoyed very much, because telling stories, whether they're my own or someone else's, is one of the great joys of my life. And for a long time, I left performing, 25, 30 years ago. Went into the corporate world, so we could rearrange our family, and my wife could take care of the children.
Yeah.
So that worked out nicely. But since then, about the only time I've really had a chance to tell stories has been when my kids were in school. I'd go every week to each of their classes and read, and it was more fun than anything else I did, you know. Certainly much more fun than, I won't talk about what it's more fun than, but so the chance to find a story and to have the opportunity to tell it to whoever's listening out there it's exciting.
And I'm particularly gratified because you told my stories, or my hometown story. So thank you.
And I got to say, it does awaken some desire in me to do something similar to what you've done. My family, roots are in Louisiana, but starting in the late 1800s, my great-grandfather came to Texas and settled in Liberty County, east of Houston. The small community of Ames is largely Louisiana refugee. Well, not largely, all Louisiana refugees, started by, I guess, three men initially, one of them being my great grandfather, and some of the stories that they tell about the founding of that that community deserve to be retold.
I would love to. So we've got to set a deadline, get that together, and come back. Rachel, I've got to ask you.
Sure.
What have you got coming up at the Ensemble and in the rest of your professional life?
The rest of my world, yes. Yeah. Thank you. The Ensemble has a great piece opening next week called Free to People. So you can go on our website and find out more about that. We have a project at the end of March. It's called an artist project about the Appalachian community. So we're excited about that coming up at the end of the month.
That's close to where I came from.
Yeah. So it's a piece all about that community. So look us up and support that. And then other things in my world.
Aren't you directing a play in a couple of months?
I am. Right after Free to Peoples at the Ensemble is Pipeline by Dominic Morisot. So it's a look at the school-to-prison pipeline and how it affects the family. So it's going to be a lot of fun, powerful group of artists.
Well, and our listeners can scroll back in our archive and hear a couple of monologues from that show, because you brought the actors on back in October, November or so. We were in here crying through one of the monologues.
It's a really powerful piece. It really is, to see the family and how it responds to the situation. So
I'm looking forward to that, too.
And then I'm a collaborator on a project called The Big Us. You can look us up at bigusproject.org, where 100 refugees will be sharing their story.
Cool.
Because we felt it's important to reflect our community, our whole community on stage. So The Big Us Project is March 9th.
Okay.
It's free for everyone. So we hope that you come and support the refugees as they tell their story.
And I saw it on Facebook.
Oh, good.
On your Facebook page.
Oh, good. But I did good.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So come and support that.
Okay.
And of course, scriptwritershouston.org has projects coming up. So if you can come and support those, we would love to have you. Third Monday of the month at 7:00 is our monthly meeting.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got you both here just 1 minute for this, but Chris was with the Ensemble at the very beginning back in
1976.
Okay. And Rachel is Associate Artistic Director there now.
I am. Bold.
So 76, 86, 96, whatever. That's 40-some years.
We would love to have him. Come on back.
Oh, yeah.
The door's open.
What's different between then and now?
We're not doing theater out of the back of a trunk or out of the house anymore.
The apartment.
Right. The Ensemble Theater has a wonderful space that we own, one of the handful of theaters in the country that owns its own space.
It's an incredible venue. Theaters. I was there just last week. The show about the Freedom Riders. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
It closed last week. Yeah. You missed that one, but the others coming up are equally as great. So, yeah.
Well, I have not participated in theater in a long time, so it's hard to say what's different now, but I'm anxious to find out.
I'm confident the theater is the presentation is equally as amazing, because your voice is great. I can only imagine hearing you in a play, and the shows we're doing, like you mentioned, Too Heavy and Frida People's coming up, and Pipeline, great works by great writers, so I'm sure that's the same.
And Chris was saying that it really started in an old house, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
literally.
Wentworth Street, right up by Alameda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're in the same neighborhood, just some blocks over, yeah.
Yeah. That's outstanding. What does it take to make a theater stay successful for 4+ decades? In one word or phrase, what's made the Ensemble? It's one of the top theaters in Houston. Why?
Tenacity.
Is that? Tenacity.
You've got to just stick to it. Tenacity.
I think community involvement would be a big part of it.
Community involvement. Mm-hmm. 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 And I would add, you tell great stories.
Yes. Very true.
Yeah.
Very true. Reaching a diverse community is our goal. So everyone's welcome.
Great. And speaking of stories, Hank, is he out there? He's getting his... We need to raise money because we need to get another headphone. By the way, Eric Heem... thank you, Eric.
Eric,
He just called in with a $100 donation. Thank you, sir.
Just
Hank?
Like
yeah, I'm here. I'm here.
Are you mic'd up now?
Yep.
Why don't you tell us about your reflections on the stories tonight, and also wrap up the fund drive. This is our last show, I guess, at the end of the winter fund drive.
Well, we did a great job with the fund drive. Of course, it only takes 90.1 seconds to give us a call at 713-526-5738. So we are still taking that. And we are still in fund drive mode until March 6th, actually. So we're good until next Wednesday, and we want people to give us a call and make sure that their donation is going to this program. So what's your story? Or go online, or again, text and go to give. Text the word give, and then you can type in 713-526-5738 and get right to it. These stories tonight were magnificent. It's a word that I use sometimes, but not that often. You know, when I reflect on these stories, I have to review and repeat what I said a little earlier about how they are extraordinarily meaningful given two things. One, of course, Black History Month, but also that we are in the fund drive mode and that this program, this station, is fueled for freedom. What we do best is produce peace, and we promote it. And I wanted to thank our tellers tonight because I think that's exactly what we did. With their awesome stories, their mesmerizing tales, their engaging and embracing senses of discovery. And I thank them very, very much. Tonight is what it is all about. Thank you, Warren. Great, great program. Yeah. Thank you.
And thank you, Rachel, Chris, and our listeners. Don't you dare move. Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. This is Warren Holloman, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after.